Hey, folks, this is Rabble Rouser, Rich
Bergeron.
Hey, this is from Tony Cal.
As well, is with us.
So,
that was a little brief attempt to play a clip there on George St. Pierre's first interview, they call it, even though it's just a TMZ guy harassing him at the airport and stuff, and he's answering a few questions. They call it his first interview. We're going to get to that later, but we got a lot to cover tonight. A lot of stuff going on. Tony's buddies are handing out turkeys down in Philly. Bernard Hopkins
right,
and
Danny Garcia.
Could you go down there and get an autograph at least on your turkey? A signed turkey?
Yeah, I got to get a signed turkey. That'd be pretty cool. Bernard made a good point. Him and Danny Garcia both said the same thing. They're fortunate enough that they can be there giving the turkeys and helping those less fortunate. Because at one time, they would have been the ones actually down there receiving the turkey.
Right. That's cool. Well, anyway, we got a lot of news to cover. We had, of course, a big boxing match over the weekend. Manny Pacquiao dominated with a capital D. Brandon Rios, which I really didn't even know he showed up to fight. I think he won maybe one or two rounds on a few cards, but didn't really engage much. Spent most of the fight in defensive mode. And just kind of stuck his tongue out at Manny every time he hit him with a hard shot. Like, ooh, that didn't hurt. Well, look at your eye, buddy. You're obviously hurting. Actually is in the news for something else too after this fight. Even though he's a Filipino hero, he promised to give aid to 10,000 families victimized by the typhoon, and he has to borrow money to do it now because they froze his accounts. The Philippine Bureau of Internal Revenue froze all his accounts, saying he owed 2.2 billion pesos, which is $50 million in back taxes as of July. Pacquiao is actually the wealthiest member of the Philippine Congress, and so he borrowed over 1 million pesos, Filipino pesos, I guess, to basically live up to his word. That's $22,700. That was before his fight Sunday with Rios in Macau, and he says he's going to borrow more to keep his word. So, more power to Manny. Although, I hope they unfreeze his account soon. He actually said, the money that was garnished by the Bureau of Internal Revenue is not stolen. This came from all of the punches, beatings, blood, and sweat that I endured in the ring. I appealed to them to remove the garnishments so that I can move and pay for my staff's salaries. I am not a criminal or a thief. said he paid taxes in the United States, and a criminal case was dropped for prosecutors for alleged unpaid taxes in 2010, but a tax claims for the 2008 to 2009 years are still pending.
You know, it sounds like he's going to have to be fighting forever at this point, because I've heard he has an entourage that dwarfs just about anyone, so...
Yeah, the entire Philippine,
you know,
country.
Yeah.
Stepping up. We also have a big fight coming up, UFC, another UFC event in November 30th here, Saturday. Usmar Paul Harris, who's banned from the UFC recently, he has signed with World Series of Fighting. So there's an interesting development there.
That seems to be a trend. That seems to be a trend, doesn't it?
Right.
Seems like you know, with our other friend, Mr. Bollinger, was it Cody? That's where he won, I believe you mentioned, right?
Anthony, World Series of Fighting contract now. Kid Anthony that just got booted from the show.
Oh, really? Yeah, see, I think we got a trend going here.
No, he hasn't signed yet, but he's next, I'm saying.
Yeah.
Anyway, Paul Harris said after the fight that was controversial there, where he didn't let off the submission hold, he believes he stopped when he noticed the referees telling him to. But anyway, he's still popular with fans, so he's 15-5 as a pro, and he's just 33 years old, so should keep fighting for a while. And his final middleweight fight was a knockout loss to Hector Lombard in December 2012, and he tested positive for elevated testosterone levels there. Prior to that, he lost by TKO to longtime UFC veteran Alan Belcher. So, hopefully he can be successful in the World Series of Fighting without steroids. Anyway, George St. Pierre, in this TMZ video that I can't get to load. He's been all over the news lately, Tom. I sent you an article from, believe it or not, Dana White should take note. The guy who actually talked to St. Pierre before opening his mouth about him, Lorenzo Fertitta, came out and said that, you know, George St. Pierre owes us nothing. So there you have it.
Well, the latest news as of today, apparently Dana had called St. Pierre and privately apologized. And he rewatched the fight and determined that, in his opinion, George did deserve the victory. Now, one of St. Pierre's trainers says nothing will be settled until Dana admits in public. He apologizes in public and admits it. Well, I don't think that's going to happen.
That would be nice. Yeah, right. Put some odds on that in Vegas.
Yeah.
Alright, I think I got the video now. I guess sound. Anyway, they caught him at the airport. Might play him up middle of the explaining. TMZ did it anyway. And he's got sunglasses on, obviously he's still got some black eyes. And he said, "I'm not a dad, I'm not in rehab, and my father is not dying." There is still some talk about him retiring, flat out retiring, but, you know, like I said last week, Dana White basically guaranteed within a couple weeks there's going to be talks of a rematch, so I don't know where he's at, but, in any case, I think he would vacate the belt if he does decide to take some significant time off before doing this rematch, if the rematch happens. There's been some interesting press on this whole week. Where, you know, we got stuff from all sides going on. Everybody's got their own opinion of what he should do, but Lorenzo Fertitta was in the news right after UFC 167, was talking to him right away. Was talking to George St. Pierre after that. He sat down and talked to him and didn't say anything publicly until after he had a full discussion with him. Whereas Dana White was bad-mouthing the guy before he had a legitimate discussion with him. Right there at the press conference. So, goes to show you why they need Lorenzo around sometimes. Because he actually talks to these people. it's funny because this is the first time I've really heard a large group of people heap it all on Dana White. Put him in a position where he needs to apologize. I don't think he's had very few opportunities where he felt he had to apologize. Number one being the stuff he said about Loretta Hunt, which need not be repeated. We had, obviously, a Manny Pacquiao fight. We had some pretty interesting fights on the undercard, too, didn't these there, Tony? Talk about this.
The main undercard fight was a rematch from a fight earlier this year, back in March, between Ivan Bradovich and
And Max Kellerman and those guys.
There was also some controversy in the Tor Hamer fight, if you call it a fight. He quit, just flat out quit, after a few rounds.
He did that last year, too, against the guy that just fought last week, the one that fought Garrett Wilson. Of course, I'm still blind for the agreement. I could have it in front of me. The Russian fighter, Mr. Hamer, quit in that fight, too. The guy that he fought this time, like I said, I don't have any of my stuff in front of me. But this guy is like the Chris Ariola school of bodybuilding.
No, he's fatter. He's a fat guy. The announcer even called him, Max Kellerman even called him short and fat, you know, but don't let that confuse you, he said. You
know. Hey, fat guy can fight. I made a career of it.
I thought that was great. I'm not a huge fan of Max Kellerman, but when he said that, I was like, wow, shoot from the hip there, Max. But he's like, yeah, you know, don't let him fool you, even though he's short and fat. He can punch. And he did. Tor Hamer looked like a little child in there. And he got beat to a pulp there. And the funniest part was his promoter, I don't have it right exactly. exactly in front of me. I'll find it here. But his promoter got rid of him on Twitter. That's how bad they thought he handled the fight. They tweeted, "You're fired," basically. They pulled a Donald Trump on Twitter. So that's pretty insulting on their part. But Tor Hamer, actually, the last time I saw him fight, he fought none other than Larry the Cable Guy. No. Is it Larry the Cable Guy? The fat guy. Is that? That's what he got his name from, right? Larry the Cable Guy. So, I forget what his real last name is, but it was that Only in America show. And Larry went to Gleason's gym. And they put the gloves on him, and they threw him in with Tor Hamer for a couple rounds. And he looked like he was scared shitless, but, you know, Tor Hamer was having the time of his life. But the opponent he likes had him right there. Anyway, didn't look too good. And, that's a tough thing to overcome, get past, and something like that on your resume as something that you're known for. Here it is. Lou DiBella dropped his own client, heavyweight Tor Hamer, via Twitter from 8,000 miles away after Hamer quit after the third round of a scheduled 10-round match against Andy Ruiz. Lou DiBella fires you. Okay. So, I got a little more on St. Pierre. We'll get to that in a minute. But, I got a lot of boxing stuff this week, actually. If I can get to it. So, Lou DiBella fired Tor Hamer. Now, overseas was the bigger and more controversial fight, I think, than the Manny Pacquiao versus Brandon Rios fight. Did you hear about this, Tony? Carl Froch and George Groves?
I did. Unfortunately, so Groves put Froch down early in the fight. I forget if it was the first round.
Yes.
Hurdle was a very competitive fight. Groves was more than handling the zone. And I expected that. Groves was a good fighter. I mean, I know Glenn Johnson's up there in age, but Groves shut him out. I mean, won every round off Johnson. And that's saying something. Johnson's a very capable fighter, even in his 40s. I mean, Groves, blanked him in the cards. So I knew he was a capable opponent for Fox. When I heard Groves got hurt, and I mean, literally, as soon as he got hurt, fight was stopped. Now, this is the second controversial stoppage in, what, a month or two's time over in Great Britain?
Yeah, that's not very comforting. But,
I remember the last fight was when they counted out, they counted the guy out at the count of nine.
Yeah, that was over in the UK, too.
Yeah, that was a Philadelphia kid. I don't know him, but, I don't know him personally. But I remember it happened. They were, 7, 8, 9, and it was, No, it's 7, 8, 9, 10 you're out, not 7, 8, 9 you're out. But this one, I heard as soon as Groves got stung, they stopped it.
Yeah, basically, Proc even said that he would consider a rematch. He's actually come out and said that he thinks the referee saved his career, saved Groves' career by stopping the fight. Which is weird, but this is one of those stories. It's reeks of corruption, but it just shows you what the problem is with boxing to begin with. You know, you have these subjective people making these decisions. In many cases, people who've never fought themselves. I mean, they show a picture of this referee. I've never seen him before. You talk about short and fat. I don't know if he's done any boxing himself, but anyway, the funniest thing about this whole story, even though it's not really funny if you put yourself in the shoes of the guy who said this, is the quote, the block quote they have for this story. And this is a guy who knows he's being quoted when he says this stuff. Tom mentioned last week that there's been a lot of crying on The Ultimate Fighter.
Yes.
Well, it happens in the UK, too, because this guy says, quote, "The referee got it wrong. It is a bitter pill for me to swallow, and I will go away and cry." Talk about the worst quote you could possibly have out there. As a boxer, especially, "I will go away and cry." I feel for the guy, but you don't want to come out and say something like that. George St. Pierre thought he had a bad quote after the fight. This guy. That's tough. Anyway, Fraud said the referee was 6 inches away from the fight. He can see what he's doing and what he's looking at. He looks into the fighter's eye and he makes a very experienced and educated decision. From where I was standing, hitting him, I almost had a couple of free hits on him. I was lining up for a couple more. At 25 years old, do you want to see a kid knocked unconscious and carried out on a stretcher? You don't. People watching from the crowd see something slightly different. But I'm devastated that I got booed in the arena. He almost got booed out of the arena. Howard Foster, he says, can see what I'm seeing. Nobody in the audience can see that. If the fight had gone on, he would have knocked me out. He would have been knocked out. Sorry. Freudian slip there. If the referee didn't get in the way and hold him up, he was going to be on the floor with a couple more shots. I'm in the ring to do my job, so is George, and we did our job fantastically. The referee is in there to do his job. You can't argue with his decision. He saved George Groves' career. He's a very good fighter who will 100% come again. I was put over in round one, fought right through to round 7 and 8, and started to break him down and got the stoppage win. What more do you want? Obviously a rematch. Groves added, Carl was in trouble from the first round. I was dictating the fight. This is his opponent. Carl Francis' opponent, George Groves. I was winning all the rounds. I didn't even realize the referee was stopping the fight. I thought he was just breaking us up. I fight with my heart on my sleeve, and I think I won a lot of respect here. And I will go away and cry. tough. Got to be, you know, the worst thing when, you know, you put together a fight like that, you're a relative unknown, this is your chance, this is your Rocky moment, and the referee takes it away from you like that. I can understand on a second or a third knockdown or a stunning situation, but, you know, the first, you haven't been knocked down yet, you've already knocked the other guy down, and that happens the first time you get in trouble. But I didn't watch it either, so I can't really speak from having watched it to tell you whether George is right here or Carl. But Carl seems definitely to make a good case for himself anyway. But it just goes to show you, any day can be your worst day in the ring. And sometimes you can get really lucky. George St. Pierre lucky.
Except it wasn't a decision.
Retirement talk. You know, we talked about George St. Pierre might retire. Well, now it's confirmed. Rich Franklin will retire after his next fight. I didn't even know he was not retired already. Shows you how much I'm following his career. But his last fight, he got schooled by Kung Lee. Knocked out. Put Franklin on the canvas. And then since that fight, he's been out of the public eye, period. He was once really one of the number one fighters in the promotion, so one of the former champions, anyway. But he spoke with Kenny Rice and Boss Rutten about his future. He said, you know, I lost my last fight, and that really kind of solidified my decision to make this my last fight coming up. I know that took me out of title contention, and so for me to get back into the title hunt would be a couple years' worth of work. And I know that. I'm 39. I'll be 40 next year. And it's getting to the point where it's late in my life, and it's really too late to have that title run. So I started questioning, what am I really fighting for if I can't make it to the title anymore? I know I'm not in title contention anymore, and I realize that. So that's how it is. And I have to film Ace Ventura, Pet Detective 4.
I'll go back to teaching now.
Oh, yes.
With a very rapid
hit
class.
He's been in the UFC for a decade, believe it or not. He was actually on the first Ultimate Fighter finale. He got a fight there, and he coached on the show twice. And he was a perfect company man, according to this article. Whenever they needed a headliner or a big name fighter to step up on short notice, it was him who got the call and took the fight. So who do you want him to fight, Tom? Last fight.
I really have to think about that. I would say that the company owes him whoever he wants. I'll have to really put my brain on that one, because remember, we've got two divisions here now. I know that he'd been competing at 205.
Chael Sonnen.
But then I think he fought Kung Lee at 185, I believe. So he said he's always been, throughout his career, he's always been very flexible at both. You know, he thought he was more of a natural middleweight, but he liked to stay up there at light heavy some too. So, I'll have to think about that one.
I'm going with Chael Sonnen. At either weight, I don't care. I just want to see Chael Sonnen get beat by Rich Franklin. He's losing to everybody else lately. He's a big one for the team. I'm sure he has a lot of respect in front of him too, so it's always nice to see him when because of the reputation of the guy he's fighting, Chael can't be at his worst. He has to be on his best behavior. So, that'll be funny. Anyway, I didn't even hear about this when it first began, but apparently Cole Miller appealed to the Massachusetts Athletic Commission following his loss to Manny Gamburian in August. I had never heard there was any controversy on this, but maybe we might have talked about the decision controversy if there was after the fact right away, but I never knew there was any kind of appeal, and I didn't even know you could appeal a situation like this, but basically he felt that Gamburian should have been ruled finished after he was given longer than a minute between the first and second rounds. Miller had hit him with several elbows that were not deemed illegal or fouls or anything like that. And Miller posted something on his official website in regards to his appeal being denied. He said, "I recently filed an appeal with the State of Massachusetts Athletic Commission for what I feel is an obvious violation of the rules as stated in Massachusetts Handbook for Mixed Martial Arts and Unarmed Combat. This violation also obviously changed the outcome of my fight against Manny Gamburian. My appeal was denied due to, quote, inconclusive evidence. The only way to come to this decision would be to completely ignore the crystal clear video evidence." Video evidence is in all caps. "It is my opinion that if the same athletic commission were trying to find a fighter guilty of a rule infraction, the exact same level of evidence would have been deemed," all caps, "overwhelming. For that reason, I would like to give the details of my appeal. Here is the breakdown of what happened. The appeal was the decision to let the fight continue after more than 2 minutes had gone by when a fighter is to receive 1 minute. If the fighter cannot continue after 1 minute, the fight must be stopped." And apparently he left a list of rules at the bottom. The lengthy numbers are referred to timestamps, which references video provided by the UFC of the bout. "Also, I wasn't allowed to argue this, but the judges gave Manny Gamburian the decision, one giving them the nod for every single round. I was told by Dana White and Lorenzo Fertitta I had won the fight. All major MMA websites scored the play-by-play for me 30-27, winning every round." Even though Miller is now 20-8, appeal is denied. His last fight was Andy Ogle, and he beat him in October. He's gone 3-4 in his last 7 fights, with all 4 losses coming by way of decision. So, what do you think about that one? 2 minutes. You get 2 minutes instead of 1. Is that fair?
I think this will be a good segue into our discussion about open scoring, because I can't wait to get at that. I know we still have a few other things to go on, but just so close. I didn't want to get started yet, but yeah, I know appeals are kind of a lost cause, but I've got so many ideas on this open scoring. I even printed out the article here for it, but maybe that's the answer. I don't know. We'll kick it around.
Right. I do want to mention Magomed Abdusalamov has been put back on life support and returned to a medically induced coma. When he came out, his temperature went up to 103 degrees, so they put him back under. He had been breathing on his own and was removed and taken out of the coma, but it just took him a few hours to go right back to the high temperature. It's pretty much a setback. They're not, you know, coming out thinking too much negativity after this, but you know, it's just the consequence of the recovery. It takes a little bit longer than you think sometimes, but hopefully he's all right. But you know, obviously, if he's still hospitalized, they're doing everything they can for him. And as Tom mentioned earlier, Dana White did apologize to George St. Pierre about some of his commentary. The UFC boss was criticized by the media for saying that a fighter owed the promotion anything. Especially, he'd later tell media in a scrum that he'd never try to stop a fighter from retiring. White, according to his trainer, White reached out to St. Pierre to offer an apology for the statements made in the post-fight press conference, but also to say that after rewatching the bout, he now believes that St. Pierre was rightfully given the decision.
Well, I don't know about that. I haven't rewatched the fight, but I was watching it pretty closely live, so I don't think I need to rewatch it to know that St. Pierre did not win the fight.
But if White thinks that's the way it is, I think he's just trying to save face. Anyway. He asked for, like Tom said, he asked for a public apology. We're doubting he's going to get it.
Yeah, I strongly doubt it.
And Dana White pretty much went scorched earth on the commission, the athletic commission, following George St. Pierre's controversial decision win over Johnny Hendricks. And, you know, they've butted heads before, the commission and Dana White, over bad decisions. It's probably their number one issue if they go back and forth over it. But basically, his post-fight news conference was lightning to George St. Pierre and the Nevada State Athletic Commission. And White said, "I think the Nevada State Athletic Commission is atrocious. I think the governor needs to step in immediately before these guys destroy this sport like they did boxing. It's absolutely 100% incompetent, and it needs to stop." And actually, there was an article I just read right after the show last week where Dana White said that all judges in Nevada, or actually anywhere, I think, you know, are going to referee or judge a fight should have grappling experience. They should roll before they go out there and make decisions. I don't know about that. I don't think that's ever going to happen. But kind of interesting. Because a lot of these guys are boxing people. You know, the athletic commission started with boxing judges. Now they're just getting thrown into MMA in a lot of cases, and they don't have any experience with really knowing what an MMA fight really is. So he makes a good point. I just don't think it's going to happen. The other thing that this article is referencing, they'd like to see not only the commission work on scoring issues, but also on testosterone replacement therapy, and come out with some more concrete guidelines and oversights, especially now that just the other day, Tom, you know, when a treatment is controversial and possibly bad for you, when see on TV a commercial for lawyers suing the companies that make these treatments, right? Just the other day, I saw the first commercial about you know, people suffering heart attacks and other issues from testosterone replacement therapy. So I'm sure that you know, some of these fighters are also going to have some of the same issues. But they're doing it to the levels that they're doing it. That one guy we just talked about a couple weeks ago was like off the charts. Drysdale, I think, supposed to make his debut, and he's off the charts for testosterone. Just ridiculous.
obviously, if, you know, that's giving people heart attacks from taking the over-the-counter stuff. What they're doing, they're going to catch up to them. So, it's definitely an issue they need to look at, and here's your chance to talk about open scoring. I think I did see a little side article on Bleacher Report today about Keith Kizer.
Right, that's the one I'm referring to, and Keith Kizer's involved in it, and it all gets back to the fifth round of the St. Pierre Hendricks fight, when apparently Mark Lehman told Johnny, just, okay, it's your bout, just go get it. But there was no sense of urgency. Now, we've seen this in boxing for forever. Excuse my bad grammar, but, you know, where, you know, the corner will mistakenly think that their guy's ahead and say, okay, just take a few rounds. Yeah, just play it cautious, play it safe. Now, and then what comes out of it? And like this article says, open scoring, from a theoretical standpoint, would make sense because every other sport in the world tells you who's winning before it's all over. So why not MMA? And we'll include boxing in that, too. And why does it always have to be this tortured math problem where we add up effective strikes, subtract takedowns, multiply by octagon control, then divide by the square root of Cecil Peebles? I mean, wouldn't fighters rather know whether they're winning or losing before their chance to do something about it is gone? Oh, Tony, what do you think about that? It's the last round of a close fight. And if you would you rather know that you really need to push it? Or would you rather know you're ahead or rather not know? What do you think?
Let me answer this as a fighter's perspective and then as a fan's perspective. As a fighter's perspective, of course you want to know. I know Keith had a fight my sophomore year, and I remember going back into the second round, and I knew I lost the first round. And the second round, I started coming on at the end. I'm in the other guy's hometown. I'm like, oh, shit, I'm going to this round, too. I'm there going, rather than even asking my coach, saying, you only need a knockout to win. And I remember them saying, you need to win this round. And I said, do I need a knockout to win? They said, I don't think so. And I was kind of, and actually, I battered him pretty good that round. I came close to that one. It went to the final bell, and I won the decision. Now, I knew I had to press the action. I had another fight out there going into the third round, and it was, I think you're ahead, but just don't want a bicycle. So from a fighter's perspective, of course you want to know if you have to press the action, if you have to. I mean, go back to Chavez Taylor. The announcers had Taylor winning like 9 of the 11 rounds. But on the cards, he was only up on 3 cards. So theoretically, if he survives, he wins. Now, there's conflicting, were they telling him, were Duva and Benton telling him to win the round, or were they telling him to survive the round? So, yeah. Could that,
and it can alter a fighter's perspective going into those last round or two. Perfect example is Canelo Alvarez and Austin Trout back in, April of this year. It was very competitive. I mean, I thought it was close, and I even had Trout slightly ahead on my cards. But with open scoring, Canelo was way ahead on the cards. So for the last two rounds, when he was kind of winded, you know what he's ahead? He played keep away. And, yes, he knew he was way ahead. Trout knew he was way behind. But at the same time, it kind of robbed the fans a little bit because Canelo went into such a defensive mode. Like Tommy Morrison against George Foreman. Morrison knew he was way ahead during the last two rounds, and he actually started jogging away. I mean, turned his back and jogged away at one point. If you know you're that ahead in a close fight, and you've been hurt, you're a little bit tired, you're going to play so defensively, you're going to be in the prevent defense, and you're going to kind of, you know, rob the fans.
Okay, now I want you to hold that thought, and I want to get your comments on it too, Rich, in a second, but they were interviewing a lot of MMA fighters, and a lot of them didn't really want the open scoring because they felt it would alter the action too much. The fighters knew exactly what the score was. Now, here's a quote from Joseph Benavidez, and this ties in exactly with what you were saying here, Tony. So his quote is, "I don't like the way it can change the way someone fights," Benavidez said. "I've seen it in boxing. Someone knows they're up by 5 rounds, and they can kind of hang back and not give it their all. Also, the guy that's down has to change his style and maybe compromise a few things." All right. But then the counter-argument to that, so what? Because if you're the better fighter, you should be able to deal with anything your opponent's throwing at you, any style. You should be able to go into any ground that the fight goes into. And if you have to come from behind and knock someone out, that's what you got to do. You see what I mean?
Yeah, well, the problem with these people that are thinking that we need that is that they obviously don't have faith in the corner. I mean, the corner is supposed to tell you when you're down and when you need that knockout. I mean, you're supposed to have objective people in your corner who can watch a fight and not sit there and root for you so much that they tell you you're winning when you're down by 4 rounds going into the fifth.
And they're telling the fighter, you know, when you need these rounds, you're way down, and you need to win these rounds, or you're not going to win the fight. And then you see, like, the scorecards, you find out, it's like, the guy won by scores of, like, 118 to 110. He won 10 12 rounds. And so, I mean, at the same time, the cornermen can be guessing, but...
Right.
You know, with Mayweather's corner, if there was open scoring in that fight with Alvarez, would they have guessed in those last 2 rounds to see Dan Ross was a draw?
Okay, but see that's a good point, though, because even if the corner's objective and is going to tell you exactly the way it is, they don't know for sure. I mean, who in the world could have pictured C.J. Ross with an idiotic, erroneous scorecard like she had? Who could have figured that?
Yeah, but the other part of it is, you know, if that gets read out loud at a certain point and everybody boos,
Now, I'll keep going on this article here. Now, Daniel Ferrer adds that he sort of agreed, saying once the fighter knew for sure he was winning, he would fight real cautious down the stretch. But then he adds, with that being said, I always ask him between rounds whether or not I won the round, so I guess I would want to know. Okay, so then it moves along, and then we get to, the question is here, think about all the times you waited for the final round to start, knowing that one fighter almost surely needs a knockout or a submission to win. Isn't that still exciting? And if he gets the finish in that situation, isn't it that much more dramatic? Because we've seen that in both of our sports, where it's like, you know, this guy's got to do something dramatic. And even if it were open scoring, it would still be the same thing. Then we'd know for sure, yeah, you got to really push it. And so they asked Keith Kaiser about this, and so he comes on and says that, he said there are two problems, all right, and I want you guys to dissect these. He said the first problem is the effect open scoring could have on the judges. Now, if you picture a very important fight for a hometown fighter in front of a highly partisan crowd, and it doesn't matter where, you could pick, he uses the example of either Newark, New Jersey, or Rio de Janeiro, but it doesn't matter where. So now, if it's an MMA fight, and after 3 rounds of a 5-round title fight, the scores are announced, and the judges have it unanimously for the visiting fighter. Now, Kaiser's quote is, first of all, you could have people throwing beer bottles and all that, Kaiser said. Second, even if they don't throw beer bottles, the judges, and I've talked to some of them about this, they'd be afraid. They'd be looking behind them during the next round, then the rest of the fight after that. There's also for the potential for the judges to be distracted. And then there's also the potential for the judges to be influenced by hearing one other scores, Kaiser said. If you're a judge who scored the first 4 rounds for one fighter, while your colleagues have it more evenly split, there's going to be some pressure on you to feel like you should give the 5th round to the other guy. All right, I want to stop this right there. We'll have more, but I'll ask you guys, shouldn't you have confidence in your ability to judge a fight regardless of what anyone says or regardless of any crowd noise? You know the fight game, you feel confident doing it. And if you don't, should you be there?
That's why it's a problem in general with judging, is because it's a subjective thing. You know, you can't really be objective in some scenarios. You see a fight a certain way. I mean, like I've talked about before, where a judge sits has influence on how he or she judges a fight sometimes. You might not have seen a certain angle, especially in boxing, because you have these ropes in your way. I mean, you can see through a cage usually. There's enough holes, you know, where it's not going to really obstruct your vision, but where a rope could be right across your eye in a certain area, you might miss a lot. So, I think they need to change where the judges sit. Put them above the rope somehow. And they need to be allowed to use monitors and see replays and stuff like that. Because I think that's, you know, has an impact on how you see the fight as well.
Sure.
But as far as, you know, open scoring being a good idea, I don't know. I mean, I think those are legitimate points that Kaiser brings up, but I don't like it for...
We have one other one here. That the other concern is how it might affect the fighters and our perceptions of them. Forget about them playing it safe in the final round. Many of them already do that when they know they're ahead, Kaiser said. But so what? They take a knee in football as part of sports. The big problem is that combat sports such as MMA, boxing, and kickboxing are among the only individual sports in which you can get injured late in the competition, find yourself unable to continue, yet still win. And he uses the example here, he says, you're leading Wimbledon or winning the Masters, and you trip and break your ankle, you forfeit, Kaiser said. It's not so simple in MMA. Say, for example, a champion is battering the challenger for the first three rounds of a title fight. Then in the fourth, he runs out of gas, fades in the face of an onslaught from his opponent, and barely survives the round. Heading into the final round, we hear the scores announced. It's 39-37 for the champ. At the start of the fifth, there's an accidental clash of heads or an inadvertent eye poke. The champ says his vision is blurry. He can't continue. Even if the judges score that incomplete round for the challenger, the champ still wins with technical decision. Now what are the fans supposed to think? Well, that's a good point, but maybe some rule changes could affect that, too.
I don't know. I don't think that's the problem, though. Like you said, you know, with judges thinking about, well, maybe they shouldn't be judging, that's really the main thing. You know, you got to figure out why these guys are there, what they know, what they don't know. There has to be more formal training as to, you know, how to score a round for what fighter. I've always thought there's way too much emphasis on wrestling. You know, if a guy gets a certain takedown at a certain point, he wins the round.
Right, takedowns. Well, I think regardless, to sum this whole thing up, we've got to admit there's a problem. And right now, even if someone doesn't agree with open scoring, maybe look at the unified rules, something, there are problems continually coming up, and it's like every suggestion just seems to get whacked down by Pete Kaiser, and no matter what we think about the Nevada State Athletic Commission, that's the kingpin. Really, if it happens there, it'll happen elsewhere, in my opinion. So, we're right back to square one if we don't like that idea. And I also find it so annoying that boxing and MMA fans are continually put in the almost the animal category. You know, where they just don't have any self-control. They'll riot, they'll go crazy. I mean, you don't hear that about golf fans or tennis fans. Even in football, the crowd gets passionate. But, you know, it's different.
Well, it's one of the only sports where usually you don't hear the score until after the fight, or after the contest is over, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's unique in that respect. And it's tough, you know? It's like, you know, look at some of these NFL games that end in bad calls. Like the Patriots, a couple of weeks ago. Tom Brady's chasing the ref into the tunnel. Why'd you pick up that fucking flag, buddy? What'd you do that for? That's bullshit, you know? And the game ends. There's nothing you can do about it. Bad call. or no call in that case, and the game ends. So, you know, there you have a situation where an official officially took a step or didn't take a right step and affected the outcome of a regular season game.
Okay, now that happened to be away, but if that would have happened in the New England home stadium, I still don't think the fans, all 70,000 of them or however many the stadium would hold, would charge the field and threaten to kill the referee and cause a full-blown riot. I've never seen anything like that.
But my point is, if that happens every week in the NFL, people would get pissed to the point they would do something about the refs, right? But in mixed martial arts and boxing, they just continue to let it stay the same. They don't do anything, and it happens all the time. Almost every week you hear of a bad decision. You know, or in the case we talked about this week, a bad ref.
And like I said, you're just starting the year off with Friday night fights. I think we had the first four fights. I mean, you guys correct me if I'm wrong. It seems to me we had three ridiculous, controversial, wrong decisions in the main event. And it just seems to go on and on and on. And then there's the weekly rant about we need a national commissioner. But nothing ever seems to change. And all this talk about open scoring, and yet, I don't know. It seems like no matter how much we talk about it, we get right back to square one. And it's the same problem, and we'll see the same thing maybe this weekend. I hope not, but...
Well, I mean, obviously there has to be some more training. That's my number one suggestion.
One point I can really remember that open scoring would have benefited, and that was the Pacquiao-Bradley fight from about 2 years ago. Because the fact that everybody and their brother, except for two or three judges, had Pacquiao ahead. And I think Pacquiao knew he was ahead. Roach knew he was ahead. Pacquiao, the last two rounds, he pulls off the gas pedal. And he's ahead by 10 rounds or 9 rounds. And the scores get red and he loses. Now imagine if going into the last two rounds, they were saying, Manny, this fight's even. Or Manny, you know, you're behind by a point. He might have turned that around and knocked Bradley out. Or at least convincingly beat him to win that fight. That was one fight I could have seen a benefit for open scoring.
So I guess maybe the rule has to be for the tournament. Almost always have to assume that you got to win every minute of every round.
Or, how about they just get rid of decisions altogether and just fight to the death?
The problem there is both guys are going to start pacing themselves and we may be there for 4 hours. You know, I guess, how many times have we seen some fights that, I mean, initially when title fights went 15 rounds down to 12, you know, I'm kind of an old school guy. But there's been enough just snooze fests. And you can tell after the first round or two, and you guys know exactly what I'm talking about, that the odds are, even though boxing's unpredictable, that it looks like we're going to have 12 rounds of the snooze fest. And if there were 15 rounds, we'd have to sit for longer. And if there were 20 or 25 rounds, we'd have to sit here till 1 in the morning. We've all seen it.
Right.
I don't know. I would say, first off, I would agree with you totally on professionalism and training and some kind of accountability. It just now, CJ Ross, I believe, took it on herself. I don't think she was formally sanctioned that I've read about. I think she just took it on herself to realize what, you know, put that weather vane out, seen what direction the wind was blowing, and said, okay, guys, I'm taking a hiatus here. And
it's not like a criminal case where the judge or the jury looks at evidence and then decides. In a case like that where a judge makes a bad decision, it's still subjective. In her own mind, she can make the argument that that's the way I saw the fight. Okay. Really, well, what can you do to a person like that? Well, here.
I guess this would come down to that if the commission, if the state athletic commissioner could get involved a little more. And I'm not saying you should do that all the time, because I hear where you're coming from, too. You don't want the judges not being themselves. but it's something that's going back to that Pacquiao Bradley situation. My God. I mean, should these people be judging? And I'd have to think that the State Athletic Commission itself, or the commissioner himself or herself, would have the authority to say, okay, I just don't think you're competent. And right now, how often do we see that happen?
Right.
There you go.
Well, they're going to have a big discussion and do something about it. Because it's not going to fix itself.
We could probably do this whole thing all night, just talking about different fights.
Yeah, I know.
it could have been good if the first of fights were, it could have been bad. And another fight just moved up my mind where, like I said, the Alvarez trap fight, I think if it's going to be a bad thing, because a fight that looked competitive was scored wide from one fighter, and he blew it on the last two rounds, really went on the bicycle, and so it's a super hard fight to represent. Pacquiao was a different story. Pacquiao, who was playing the tape, moved to his right hand, in turn, ended up losing the fight. Another fight that reminds me of that was Devil Hayes Trinidad, back in 1999. I remember watching
that. Right. I remember that.
We were all a little tuned that night. We were drinking pretty heavily. But Dana Hoya, his decisions and his whole career were just utterly puzzling. He had the fight against Trinidad, which I thought he clearly won, and he was the majority decision. Now, he gave away the last three rounds, 111-12. I don't think he threw a single punch in those three rounds. He just literally skirted around the ring. So we're all figuring he wins at least minimum of 8 rounds, possibly 9. We thought he swept the first 9 rounds. And he was the majority decision. And I remember the first 3 to 4 rounds, he was peppered Trinidad with combinations. Trinidad was bleeding out the nose on his white trunks, but from their stain of blood. So I think everyone just dominated the fight. And then he ends up losing. And I remember the one judge gave Trinidad 3 of those first 4 rounds. I remember thinking, how was that possible? And that landed no punches of consequence, and he was getting hit flush with combination. And it doesn't matter if he didn't get knocked down or hurt, he was getting hit with closed punches. I thought the actual goal of boxing was closing effective punches as your first general basis of scoring. And then Dale Hoyer ends up giving that fight away. But I'm saying, like, his whole career, the fight you think he lost, he won. He had the fight with Whitaker. A lot of people thought he lost that fight.
Mm-hmm.
That was weekend of Nationals 97, so I'll be completely honest, we were all at a sports bar that night. I really don't remember except for trying to average a beer around. And I think I succeeded. I couldn't believe who won that fight. But that was a controversial decision. You had Dan LaHoya, Trinidad, we just talked about. The first Dana Hoogan-Mosley fight was a split decision. I thought Mosley won. That's a decision. Second time around, I thought Dana Hoogan clearly won. Mosley got a unanimous decision. Dana Hoogan fights Felix Stern. Clearly Stern wins. Dana Hoogan gets a decision.
I could never figure out his career.
And then the last great point on that was his fight with Mayweather. Which a lot of people came up to me and said, Dana Hoogan won that fight, he got robbed. And I said, no, he didn't. The judges that had it, 115, 113 Mayweather, were right. Mayweather clearly won 7 rounds. We were talking about this 2 weeks ago, or 3 weeks ago. Mayweather clearly won 7 rounds. In Dana Hoogan's 5 rounds, he may have dominated a little bit more and landed better punches, and it may have seemed that he was winning the fight, but in essence, he was only winning that 1 3-minute segment of a 12-round fight. And he won 5 of those. And Mayweather won 7. He may have said, if he loved the fight as a whole, and if it was 46-minute brawl, he may have said, yeah, Dana Hoya won. He was a street fight. Dana Hoya won. But in a boxing match on a 10-point mud system, in 12 rounds, Dana Hoya lost. And maybe if there was open scoring, and you could see, when it was the 8th round, that he was tied, dead even, he wouldn't have gave away in rounds 9, 10, 11. But then again, maybe he would have. Dan Hoya had a tension, always fighting the wrong strategy at the wrong time.
Well, I know they started it in the WBC to do open scoring, and it never really made it into any big pay-per-view fight for anybody to discuss it at length and really make a big deal out of how great it was. So I don't think it's going to survive in either sport for too long. If they're still doing it, I don't know if they're still doing it with the WBC at all. But I don't think they're even going to try it in MMA. I would think that they'd be better off just training judges in how to score fights differently between boxing and MMA, and you know, how to score and how not to score, and like Tom said, have some accountability for these judges who fuck it up.
Right. I mean, and I'll get back down to the state commission. And right now, we're not hearing anything. I mean, okay, I'll ask you guys, what are the credentials for a judge? How do you get that job? You just send in an application and, hey, I've been a fight fan for years and I want to be a judge, or is it who you know? How did CJ Ross get that job? Does anyone know?
It's when you go to get your glasses prescription, they ask you if you want to be a judge.
I can see how you can get an official license. Because, like, my dad applied for a coordinator's license. He didn't show any credentials. Basically, he just sent in the state, the Pennsylvania State Athletic Commission, and he was a coordinator. He was not a trainer. He was not the lead guy, but he was the second. He was pretty much, you know, you can get a hold off the street. Get him paid $20 for a year and fill out his license, and you can get that. Tell them the coordinator guy is the bucket. Now, for Pennsylvania State, for judging and officiating, I know you have an application to fill out. Yes, okay. I'm not sure if you have to require any tests, because I've never applied to those. I might be there just for the hell of it. Just to see if I can get licensed as a judge.
Yeah, I'm really curious. Just if you could get the application. Well, we could probably find that stuff online, but I mean,
looking like Pennsylvania Boxing Commission. On Google or whatever. I
have
a paper
we
did my
somewhere. Okay, but let's hope that we can get an answer to that, because what would that say about the state of both of these sports, that if you just put in an application and don't have really the background or the technical knowledge or the ability to judge a fight, well, it's serious business. We're talking about someone's livelihood.
Maybe we need to...
Maybe
we need to go back in time and go back to the media newspaper decisions. I like the way that Friday Night Fights does the Facebook vote on every round. They seem to get it right most of the time. Why don't they factor that stuff in? We got the technology to do that, right?
Say they had a couple at the spectrum I went to that Bernard Hopkins fought on.
Barry may have done a couple of the undercard fights, but when he came to the main event, it was a guy like Steve Smoker doing it, or Earl Morton, or Frank Cappuccino, somebody that was a championship caliber official. Now, Gary, since has got licensed in the state of New Jersey, Delaware, and Connecticut. He's done frequently, and he's done 12 rounds like USDA title fights. But just like a fighter, he had to build himself up for being championship level. That I know because I remember going to cards, and he was refereeing a couple of the undercard bouts, but he never would referee like the championship bouts, even if they were USDA or NABF, and definitely not WBA, WBC, IBF. But now I see that he's getting those assignments. He refereed a couple of them. Flag fights down in Philadelphia at the Leah Cool Center a couple of years ago. I even saw him a few minutes later, and I asked him, what was it like to referee such a legend like Bernard Hopkins, the first out Hall of Famer? And I said it was also tough because he was, trying to bend the rules in there. But that's one example that I know on how a referee builds himself up. Judges, unfortunately, I cannot speak of.
Yeah, I know about that one. Anyway, I think we've beat this horse to death.
Okay, well, revolution starts somewhere, okay?
Right, exactly.
We're starting it here, so change is in the air, I feel it.
Talk amongst yourselves, fans. We'll hash it out. Anyway, it is a really funny story. We don't often bash Dana White here on this show, do we? Well, we have Dana White on the Underground. He's pretty famous for making cameo appearances there. And the other night, somebody posted a thread, somebody named Reggie Warren Jr. They say it like I'm supposed to know who that is, but I don't. He posted a thread on the Underground calling for Dana White to, quote, cash out and retire, unquote. And, of course, as MMA fans will do, half of them agreed with the statement and half argued that Dana White is God's greatest gift to MMA. So, first Dana White addressed the poster directly, Reggie Warren Jr. Hey, Reggie, go fuck yourself. There is another bad word for all of you pussies on the UG. And pussies in all caps, of course. Now, poster after that.
STFU, I heard, was on there, too.
Yeah, that's coming. That's coming. Don't worry. We're getting to that. Poster mentioned that Timothy Bradley and Juan Manuel Marquez made a lot of money. Of course, Marquez made at least $6 million, while Bradley made $4 million. $4.1 million for a fight that sold under 400,000 pay-per-view buys. Dana responded to this over a series of posts. STFU and go away. For those of you not internet savvy, STFU means shut the fuck up. That he said, Dana White said, if you hate the UFC so bad, then WTF, what the fuck are you doing here? Go follow One Direction or something else. Bradley wished he makes what GSP makes, so the fact that you have no clue what you are talking about and you hate me and the UFC, just get the fuck out of here. Yes, dipshit, GSP makes big fucking money. You didn't know that because it's none of your fucking business. You also have no clue what JH makes, which I think he means Johnny Hendricks. Bradley wishes he made what Johnny made too. And GSP fights three times a year. They do not, said Dana. Of course, one other poster did point out that GSP only fought twice in 2008, 2009, 2010, and 2013, and only once in each 2011 and 2012. So Dana took the bait and went off a little more. He says, dickhead, you will know what a certain fighter makes if he wants to say it. I, on the other hand, will say whatever the fuck I want because I do know what they make. Okay, I popped in to say hi to the UG. Always fun, boys. Don't get butthurt and take shit personal. This is the way I talk, and I love talking to fight fans. You know me by now. I have been here for 13 years, and if you don't like me or the way I talk, then you probably shouldn't talk to me. There are plenty of other personalities and cool people to talk to in this sport. See you on December 28th.
Okay.
And he also added, I don't get trolled. It's normal for people not to like me. I don't expect everyone to agree and like me, but I come and talk to everyone, even the haters. It's fun. This is part of the business that I really love. That's why I like Twitter, and I don't have to type so much. Okay, now I am really leaving. Night, UG. Even Ian McCall actually chimed in at one point on this thread, stating that fighters make way more than what gets reported online, those numbers being the official reported salaries. I know Dana gives out Twitter bonuses, but I wonder if he gave Ian McCall an underground bonus for that.
That's good.
Anyway, I also sent you guys some stuff about CTE and traumatic brain injuries. It's been a real big issue in both MMA and boxing lately. And there's some studies being done to shed some light on that. And it's, you know, it's a lot of disturbing stuff. But as we talked about, there's really not much we can do. I mean, you really can't change the sport to make that happen less. But maybe they need to do more testing to make sure they catch this stuff before it becomes fatal. We do have a story again this week of another fighter dealing with a coma situation. Dan McKinnon, we talked a little bit about last week. He was on life support after his fight, his last fight, but he's doing better. He was stopped in the 10th round of a brutal light heavyweight fight with Robert Berridge, and he was lucid during a post-fight interview, but like Magomed Abdusalamov there, he had a swollen face. 30 minutes later, he was in the hospital where a surgeon opened up his skull to deal with bleeding on his brain. He went into an induced coma, and his life was hanging in the balance. And he not only lived, but he lived up to the stories about his incredible toughness. By Monday morning, he was conscious and cracking jokes. As we know, boxing and MMA, they're not for the faint of heart. It's a brutal sport. You have to be tough. This is one of the lucky guys. He's going to live to, do something else. I guess, he's a family man, so it's probably going to make it a lot easier for him to make the decision to do that more full-time now, having a wife and kids to deal with. But he's definitely going to make a full recovery. I just don't see him going back in the ring after something like that. Neither do his friends, so it's probably going to be end up being his last fight. And that's what you call, I guess, a reality check. And something like that happens, then you have to deal with that kind of a medical situation. But hopefully it's not too financially damaging to him as far as the cost for the recovery and all that. You hate to see that happen, especially, when a guy has to give up on his dreams pretty early in that situation. And one of his friends was quoted at the end of the article saying, he loves boxing, but he loves his family more.
Well, I'm glad he's got his priorities good. There you go.
And Dana White, we just talked about a minute ago, he's back in the news for something else. He's going to be the executive producer. He's teamed up with the executive producer of The Ultimate Fighter to put together a series called The Fighters, which is a new show about the Boston boxers. And that's interesting. It's going to be on the Discovery Channel, which I get, so that's even cooler. I think it's going to be sometime next year. We don't know the format of the show or how many episodes we'll be airing. But if it's anything like they've done Boston's Finest on TNT about the cops in Boston, I think it would be pretty good. I like that type of reality show with the way they follow all the calls and keeps it pretty real. They go on raids and stuff with these guys. And I know a couple guys that are actually in that. Because they've done the Battle of the Badges stuff in Boston, so That's always cool when you see people you've personally met on TV every week. I think that premieres tonight, actually. The new series, new season. But anyway, the Fighters has a teaser clip out there, and it's going to pretty much revolve around South Boston, which is actually where White used to live and also manage a boxing ring, Jim. And it also features a former friend and former business partner of White's, trainer Peter Welch. And it's really the first time White's done anything outside of MMA, so it's interesting. But we'll see how that goes. I'm definitely going to keep an eye out for that. And as we all know from reading stories about Dana White, what's also interesting about this is that he got booted out of South Boston when he lived there because Whitey Bulger demanded a tribute from his business. And he didn't want to pay it, so he hopped on a plane and ended up out in Vegas with the Fertittas, and the rest is history. But now he's going back to his roots there in South Boston, trying to do something with his and his son.
Well, now that Whitey Bulger's not there, I guess he doesn't have to worry about anything, huh?
Yeah, actually, at last I heard, Whitey's going to Florida. He's gonna retire in Florida, I think, because they got him on a murder charge down there. So they're gonna try him again. So he's in transit officially. So we'll see what happens with that. But yeah, Dana White getting back to boxing. What's interesting about this as well, something else on top of all the other reasons, is they've been mentioning that he was an amateur boxer, trainer and manager, former amateur boxer. And I've said this 100 times, I've seen no evidence anywhere that he ever had a formal amateur boxing match. So I don't know how you're going to call yourself a former amateur boxer or call someone else that. With no proof. I've never seen any proof. And if there was proof, I'm sure Dana White would want it out there, especially if he was successful in that one fight or however many fights. But they just call him that. Because they think, you know, if you're a boxer-sized instructor, that qualifies you. I don't think he was even a trainer or a manager of boxers, either. And it kind of infers that in this article, so. Whoever wrote that, go back to journalism school. I think that's pretty much it. Dana White for tonight. But, as I mentioned, Fertitta corrected him, and came out and said that GSP doesn't owe the company anything. So that was nice to see. The guy with the real money behind the thing coming out to give the company line instead of the bald guy with only 9% interest in the whole deal, who's never fought a day in his life. I think Fertitta's probably had more fights than Dana. He had an older brother growing up, so I think they've had enough fights between them. Anyway, here's a story about a high school football coach accused of knocking out a student player. Thunder Mountain High School, I think this is in Alaska. He's going to be arraigned next month on assault charges. He taught 6th grade math at Floyd Dryden Middle School and was assistant coach for the Falcons at Thunder Mountain High School. Now he faces felony criminal mistreatment in the first degree and misdemeanor assault in the fourth degree. The charges stem from an impromptu boxing match at a Gold Beach, Oregon football camp in the summer of 2012, in which Wall allegedly knocked a Juno student unconscious. The district attorney actually considered dismissing the charges, largely because of the expense of flying the student down for an appearance during a trial, but he said on Wednesday that he never actually filed a motion for dismissal of the case. And actually there were donations. People offered donations so that they could fly the kid down there. So he's going to proceed with the case. And the caseload for this DA is about 800 to 1,000 cases a year with a tight budget. And this guy expects 3/4 of his staff to be laid off soon. They're going to try this guy for a little impromptu boxing match. Possible trial would be in 6 months or next May. And Wall allegedly celebrated after knocking out the then 14-year-old player in an incident that was also captured on videotape. And he and head coach Bill Boyer lost their jobs with the football team. He also turned in his resignation as a teacher at the beginning of the school year. So I guess he's our loser of the week. Even though he won by knockout. That's too bad. Old guy like that picking on a 14-year-old kid in front of people on video. It's not too smart. And the UFC and MMA is back in the news lately. The New York story is heating up again. I don't know if you've seen all this stuff, Tom, but it seems like every week there's a new angle on the New York situation. They just recently released a study that said it would bring $135 million in annual revenue for the state of New York. It's been banned there since 1997, and there's all kinds of new efforts to get it to a vote. From what I understand, it's not going to be able to happen until next year, so I don't understand why they're all getting up in arms about it now. What's the significance of whether it's just because of this report or what? All of a sudden, everybody's talking about it now. I thought it wouldn't happen until they actually do their voting next year at all, if it's possible at all. I don't know. But it's back in the news, so people are talking about it. $135 million. You'd think it'd be an easy decision. But when you got politicians tied up to the union, I guess it's tough to go out on a limb and vote for something that makes sense. Alright, so what do we got for boxing coming up this weekend, Tony?
A lot of turkey.
A lot of turkey?
Yeah.
People going to be boxing their turkeys? Taking it home?
Stevenson coming up as the first round knocking out of Chad Dawson, and then the seventh round stoppage of Tavoris Cloud. He is defending his title against Tony Bellew. Tony Bellew is 21-1. Well, actually, 20 wins, 1 loss, 1 draw, 12 knockouts. Adonis Stevenson is 22-1, 19 knockouts. Bellew here, I don't know much about him. He looks like he is a British fighter. He's fought the majority of his career, which is his whole career, over in Britain. I don't really recognize any of them. The only fighter I recognize on his roster, his resume, was he has a ninth round stoppage win about a year ago over Edison Miranda. And Edison Miranda going into that fight was 35-7, and looks like his last 6 fights before that he had gone 3-3. So Miranda was really on the downside going into that fight. Bellew stopped him in 9 rounds, so we got him fighting Adonis Stevenson on Saturday. Let's see if we got any other big fights coming up on Turkey weekend. Nigeria, if you want to go to that. Got a fight in the Philippines. No names on there that I really know. A couple in Russia. Okay, over in the United Kingdom. Derek Chisora and Andre Pala. Chisora had that. He was the fighter of that controversial win just a few weeks ago. Down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, you got Jeff Leftfoot Lacey continuing his comeback trail.
I didn't even know he was still fighting.
He lost to Roy Jones, that stoppage loss in 2009, and then he had one fight, which is another loss, and back in 2010 to DePierre Smith, a 500 record fighter out of Philadelphia, who I know a lot of his sparring partners. This is his first fight since that. And he's fighting a guy by the name of Martin Verdin, who's 20-16, few draws. So I guess they're trying to break Lacey in kind of easy. His first fight in about 3 years. So, is he still fighting? Technically, no, not till this weekend, because he hasn't had a fight in 3 years.
Right.
Small card of Matthew Allenberry Jr. on it. Fight in Reading, PA, this weekend. I was invited to go to it, but I'm leaving for vacation Sunday morning, so I'm a little bit busy. Originally, Harry Yorgi, a good friend of ours, former guest, was going to be playing the main event that night. He was going to be fighting Lee Murtaugh of Great Britain. They were fighting for the WBU middleweight title. That fight canceled. Harry actually just posted it on Facebook a couple days ago. Murtaugh got injured, had to pull out of the fight. They could not get a replacement. So that fight is off. Stepping up into the main event now is the actual promoter's son. He's put on by Marshall Compton. He put on that same card that Tom and I went to in King of Prussia a few months ago. And Tom commented the same thing, was the guy's the promoter of the card, but he's also working some of the corners. Isn't that like a conflict of interest? And does that influence the judges? Yeah, remember that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and now his son, Travis Kaufman, is fighting. I saw Travis back in August. It was his first fight in about 6 months. And he looked a little flabby into that fight. And he really didn't look in that good a shape. And he had a tough fight with Aaron Lyons. Back and forth, Kaufman won it with a late surge, 8-round decision. He was 233 for that fight. And he training with Bernard Hopkins, trainer Nazim Richardson, he was battling to get in better shape. But for his last fight in September, he was 244, 11 pounds heavier. Second round stoppage over Stacey Frazier, who I don't know much about. Now, in this fight, he's fighting a guy by the name of Jason Barnett. Kaufman is 26-19 knockouts. Barnett is 14-14, 7 knockouts and 8 losses by knockout. Once again, not a fighter that I'm tremendously familiar with. He's from Midwest area. So even his 14 wins can be a case of fighting guys, you know, with like good records. Now, I see on here, he actually had a fight with Mike Perez, who recently was the one that put Maglamed in the hospital. Perez knocked him out in one round. He had couple straight fights with fighters with decent records. He fought Big John Poor a couple years ago. John Poor had a good record. It was a built-up record, fighting like guys from tough man competitions. Once he got exposed, he was against the Miranda. He went straight downhill, knocked out John Poor. He fought Mike Perez, got knocked out in one round. In fact, he had 4 consecutive fights where he lost in a 4-5 round. So it's looking here that, you know, he's a mid-best player with a 500 record, but not that good. So Kaufman should be able to win this fight, probably rather handily too. Also on the card, we have Santos de Alba. We have Emil Rodriguez versus Travis Thompson. Tom and I saw him fight a couple months ago. And tough fighter, always in good shape, but he just always comes out there and just fights. Puts no skill into it. He fights in a way that the Rocky 1 version of Rocky would have said, "Oh, yo, kid, you don't fight with no skill out there. You fight like a day and eight." Which is a shame, because he's tough and he's always in shape. And then one of my favorite young fighters is on the card, Khalid Whitmore. He's the guy that always comes to the ring dancing to Roller Coaster with the big afro wig. And he's 3-0, 2 knockouts, and he's playing a guy by the record of 1-2. And whatever happens in his fight will be entertaining. Sometimes his ring walks long, the loss lasts longer than the fight. It doesn't matter because you give the fans their money. I mean, he's such an engaging, funny, charismatic guy. You can't help but like him. But that's really all I got for this weekend. We were at Paul Spider Porter fighting down in West Virginia. He's on his comeback trail, still hoping to eventually get his name in the Mayweather sweepstakes, because apparently he beat Mayweather up in a sparring session like a decade ago.
We'll see about that. Well, we got one last fight to talk about, of course, a whole fight card. The Ultimate Fighter 18 finale this Saturday. And, of course, we don't know two of the people that are going to be on this card right now, because they're going to fight tomorrow night on the show, even though they've already fought in real life. On reality TV, it takes a while to find out who wins. But basically, we've got one fight decided. The main event has already been in stone for a while. Gray Maynard versus Nate Diaz there. That's a pretty interesting matchup, I think. Gray Maynard, I would say, is the favorite in this one. But Nate Diaz is nobody to take lightly.
I think it's just a lose. I really think it is. The Diaz brothers, both of them have great boxing. They have dangerous submissions, but they've shown a weakness to handle powerful wrestlers. And I think that Gray is a big, strong guy for in his weight division. And I think if he fights a smart fight, I don't see him losing. I think it's going to be his. And Diaz is already looking past Gray. He's talking about getting back into title contention, and it's usually a bad sign when fighters start talking about all the other fights they have coming up. So I'm going with Gray on this one.
Well, wouldn't it be funny if he did such a shitty job that Dana fired him? Then he's going to have to talk about fighters in another league, literally.
Yeah,
I'll fight this guy or that guy. We'll see. He's only 16-9, while Maynard is 11-2-1, so by statistics alone, he looks like the underdog, so we'll see what happens. But I definitely think Gray Maynard has a lot more power than one. But his last fight, he didn't get to use it. He got knocked out pretty quick, from what I remember. But, of course, the two main events below that are the finals of the Ultimate Fighter. And one of them is Juliana Pena, 4-2, versus...
Unknown Fighter.
Because we don't know until tomorrow night who her opponent's going to be. And what's also interesting is the sixth fight on the card, Roxanne Modafferi, is listed against another unknown fighter. So it makes me wonder what that could mean. It's going to be the loser of whoever fights tomorrow. Going to fight Mortaferi. Which will be interesting if it's Jessica McCrokey, because that would be a rematch of what we've already seen on the show. We have Chris Holdsworth is already in the finals, all in stone, against Davey Grant, who made the finals last week because Anthony couldn't make weight. Grant's 8-1 in his professional career. Holdsworth is 4-0 officially. Jessamyn Duke is also going to be fighting Peggy Morgan, a couple of castmates there. Both of those ladies are 2-0 in their careers and had very good fights on the show. Jessamyn, of course, had the raccoon look for most of the show with the double black eyes. Jessamyn, she knows the fight game. She likes to do it, and she showed a lot of heart in her fight. So she could stick around for a while if she puts on a good show against Peggy Morgan. And like I mentioned, Roxanne is the sixth fight of the night. We don't know who she's fighting yet. We also have a couple guys I really haven't seen much of. Drew Dober, 13-4, fighting Sean Spencer, who's 10-2. We've got WEC convert Rami Yaya, who's 19-7, fighting Tom Minamaki, who is 25-1. That's 20 wins, 5 losses, and 1 draw. Never heard of Ninamaki. You ever heard of that guy? Khan?
No.
I don't know if he's a new guy or what, but he's on the card. You got Akira Korasani, who's 11-3, fighting Maximo Blanco, who's at 9-4-1. The guys with cool names fight, I guess you could call weird names for those guys. Got Jared Rosholt, who's 8-1, fighting Walter Harris, who's 4-1, and finally Ryan Benoit, who's 7-2, fighting Joshua Sampo, who's 10-2. That's really it. From my side, I don't have any other pressing news. It was TJ Grant that Ray Maynard last lost to. Yeah,
right, and then before that, Gray chased Clay Guida around for 3 rounds, if you remember that one.
I actually thought Clay Guida won that fight, and, you know, even if you didn't like his style, you didn't like the way he fought, I think he landed the more damaging punches, even though, you know, obviously Gray had a lot more power behind every punch he threw.
All right, I'm the commissioner. You're coming into my office one day. We're going to watch that. You tell me what you say. No, seriously. Well, just agree to disagree. Okay.
Yeah. But I don't know when I
watch. That's pretty much all I have. So we got a good weekend coming up. Let's enjoy it, huh?
Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Don't eat too much turkey. And fail to make weight for your fights. You ate too much turkey. So I guess that's it for us. And we will have a guest next week. That's been two straight weeks without a guest, so that's never good for us.
All right, guys. Make sure happy Thanksgiving. Talk to you next week.
All righty.
Happy Thanksgiving, guys, and happy Thanksgiving to all our fans out there, and I'll see you guys next week.